You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from The Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.
This is the last constant of the year. So before we get going, I have one of those gross pitches to make that makes me feel dirty. It's really simple, though, so let's just get through it together. If you like this show, I'm asking you to think about supporting it financially by going to patreon.com/theconstant and signing up as a patron. If you do, you will get ad-free early access to new episodes and monthly bonus episodes. But more than that, you will be helping to keep this show going. You might not know this, but it's been a really rough year for podcasting. A few years back, a bunch of money flew into this space, thinking they'd make an easy buck by drowning the market in corporate content. They bought up shows, airdropped lazy celebrities with microphones into your feeds. Sometimes they just took episodes of television shows, stripped out the video, and used their media clout to push that stuff onto you. The net effect has been that podcasting has become more predictable and less adventurous. And a lot of good people who do good work have paid the price with layoffs and bad deals. Advertisers have grown flighty, and a lot of podcasting apps, Stitcher, Radio Public, Google Podcasts, have all called it quits. Many listeners on those platforms didn't jump to new ones. Or when they did, they didn't bring all their old shows with them. Everybody who makes podcasts has suffered. But I have been somewhat insulated from that because of the patrons who back this show. I still have to worry about losing audience for sure, and I'm not excited about there being fewer advertisers willing to put dollars into fewer commercials, but I know that there is a small yet loyal bunch of listeners out there who trust me no matter what I do and where I go, and that is a really liberating thing. I think this last year has been a great example of that trust. If you look back at the episodes produced, it is, frankly, pretty wild. We started out the year with a very dense look at the history of evolutionary theory before jumping into a menagerie of weird war stories. Then it was Disneyland from Heather, kablam, and then a hard turn into a city being destroyed by a volcano. We covered serious science and serious history, but also a radio call-in show hoax and a weird post-Cold War nuclear weapon conspiracy theory. Not to mention my two proudest moments of the year, The Captain and the Serpent and 99% Conspicuous, where I brought in the voices of fascinating experts. There is no parent company imaginable who would possibly approve that sort of spread. And if I were dependent on ad dollars alone to make this show, there's no way I'd feel free to stretch and grow and surprise that way. And that would make me very sad. But I know there are people out there who will follow me down all those weird roads. People who will even grant me a mulligan now and then if something doesn't quite click. I don't want this show to be implastic. I don't want you to feel like you know what's coming next. And I don't want to feel that way myself. There are a few things I feel humbly, that separate The Constant from a lot of other podcasts in the ecosystem. But that one, the latitude to go in unexpected directions, that might be the thing I like the most and the thing about which I'm proudest. So if you can, please think about joining me and helping to keep The Constant weird. Head over to patreon.com/theconstant and sign up. You can find a link, as always, in the show notes. And if you can't afford that, or just aren't sure you want to spend money that way, I get it. I get it very much. Thank you. But maybe you could do me and everyone else who listens a favor and tell a friend. Word of mouth is the main way, It's practically the only way that people discover this show. So if you know someone you think might like it, tell them about it. Or post about it on your social media, if that's the sort of thing you do. I think social media is kind of a bane on this earth, but that's a discussion for another time. If you use it, maybe you'd like to share this thing you like with the people you theoretically also like on Facebook or Instagram or that thing that used to be Twitter. I don't know. And no matter what, thank you for listening. I couldn't possibly express how much it means to me that you're out there, so I won't even try. I'll just get off of this recording session and let you hear this year's holiday episode, which is itself a bit of a surprising zag, I hope. Thanks again. Oh, and one last thing. While this is a Christmas episode, it is still an episode of The Constant, and it has more potentially objectionable material than the mean, including violence, rape, murder, death, and a whole lot of sex. So this might not be for everyone, especially kiddos. I'd advise at least giving it a listen first. All right, here we go.
One. Too many notes.
This is a Christmas story. But just what makes it one is not immediately evident. You might think that this song is a Christmas song, especially once the sleigh bells come in. But no, this is Schlittenfart, which is crudely funny to modern English speakers like myself in a way that its composer, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, would most definitely have appreciated, he being both one of history's greatest composers and one of its greatest fart lovers. In his letters, particularly those written to his cousin, Maria Anna Thecla, Mozart expounded at length and detail repeatedly about farts and shit and butts. Writing in one particularly infamous passage, "Well, I wish you good night, but first shit in your bed and make it burst. Sleep soundly, my love. Into your mouth your ass you'll shove." In that same letter, he told Maria, "Wee, by the love of my skin, I shit on your nose so it runs down your chin." He even wrote this song, Canon in B-flat major, and named it for the punchline of what was apparently his favorite joke. What can you do that I cannot? The answer, and the title, Lick Me in the Ass. Sounds prettier in song. So feel free to laugh it up when I say that the title of this jingle is Schlittenfart. Mozart certainly would have. But Schlittenfart is not about farting or even schlittening. The word means sleigh ride. And while it may have served as a sort of prototypical holiday season tune in the centuries to come, it was not about Christmas either. Schlittenfart was the third of Mozart's three German dances, although it was probably not written at the same time as the others. It was, however, most likely written in the same year, 1791, which was by any measure an extraordinarily eventful year in the life of the young fart smeller Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. 1791 was the year in which Mozart produced Ave Vernum Corpus. String Quintet Number 6. Concerto for Clarinet in A Major. Piano Concerto Number 27. The Masonic Cantata. He completed, to whatever degree he did, Kyrie in D minor. Fantasia in F minor for mechanical organ. Andante in F for a small mechanical organ. Aww. He composed a quintet featuring Benjamin Franklin's glass harmonica. He composed the three German dances, including Schlittenfart, of course. But earlier in that year, he'd written six German dances. And then four German dances. And afterwards, another two. He wrote 12 minuets, 9 contradances, 3 cantatas, and noodled on a dozen or so other pieces. And that is just the little stuff. He also managed to compose 2 operas that year, La Clemenza di Tito and his masterpiece, The Magic Flute. And finally, Mozart used 1791 to work on his toweringly famous unfinished Requiem in D minor. Which, if you know anything about Mozart, should clue you in to the other important thing he did in 1791. He died at just 35 years old. And his cause of death gets us one step closer to the Christmas part of this Christmas story. In short, nobody knows. When Mozart died, there was no autopsy performed. His medical records, to whatever degree they might have ever existed, are lost. His remains were buried in a common grave, meaning that after 10 or 20 years, his body was exhumed to make room for some other poor schlub. What happened to Mozart at this point is anybody's guess. In the custom of the time, he was likely reinterred somewhere else, less prestigious and public, and perhaps with others. It was pretty common to crush the bones of the dead down at this stage, so that they would take up less room. Whatever state they were left in, and wherever they were deposited, the records of that action don't exist. However, in the late 1800s, a Viennese phrenologist, by the name of Joseph Hertel, came into possession of what he thought, or said he thought, to be Herr Mozart's skull. It had been stolen, the story goes, by a gravedigger, Joseph Rothmeier, who supposedly had tied a string to Mozart's head at the time of his initial burial, so that when it came time to dig him up and move him to his new digs, Rothmeier would know whose skull was his and purloin it for future profit. In 1902, the skull came into the possession of the Mozarteum, yeah, you heard me, in Salzburg, Austria, who proudly claimed for the following century that they had their namesake's head. But mitochondrial DNA testing performed in 2006 cast serious doubt on that. With approximately no evidence whatsoever, then, there is essentially no chance that we will ever know what killed Mozart. But that hasn't stopped a lot of people from trying. And I mean, a lot of people. In the December 2010 issue of the British medical journal, Lucien Carhausen of the University of Brussels published an analysis of each potential cause of death that had been posited for Amadeus up until that point. He counted 140. With a further diagnosis of 29 mental disorders unrelated to mortality. So let's go through them. First off, you've got the easy pitches. Communicable acute diseases. Influenza, staph infection, strep infection, meningococcal infection, several varieties of septicemia, scarlet fever, measles, typhoid, typhus, tuberculosis, syphilis, malaria. Then you've got the non-communicable acute conditions. Fungal infection, maybe, or a brain bleed, or an autoimmune disorder. It could have been trichinosis from eating undercooked pork, or liver disease from too much drink. He may have had lead poisoning from adulterants in those drinks, or mercury poisoning from his hats, or any great number of other poisons which have been argued as incidental, accidental, or premeditated murder, or suicide, in all possible configurations. Kidney disease, caused by toxins, infection, or congenital problems, has long been a favored avenue. Heart disease, congenital, bacterial, or environmental. He may have suffered from hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, leptospirosis, dermatopolymyositis, rat bite fever, Henoch-Schönlein purpura, epilepsy, manic depression, ADHD, OCD, Capgras delusion. That one's out of left field even for this ballgame if you know anything about Capgras delusion. Not to mention, of course, the murder plots. Mozart's final and unfinished Requiem was commissioned anonymously, and that has served as the bed for an enormous number of conspiracy theories about the death which cut its completion short. Allegedly, Mozart's widow, Constance, told the English music publisher and organist Vincent Novello that Mozart had told her he believed he was being poisoned, and that the party or parties behind his murder were also the ones who commissioned the Requiem. So, who was, or were, these parties? Maybe the Masons, according to the poet and philosopher George Friedrich Dahmer, who thought that Mozart had encoded the magic flute with the organization's greatest secrets. This was backed up by numerous others, including German physician Dieter Kerner, who wrote more than 30 papers arguing for Mozart's Masonic poisoning into the 1970s. German parliamentarian Hermann Allwart thought the Freemasons were a red herring. No, it was the Jews what murdered Mozart, he said. Boy, that's surprising. Kind of a common refrain for Allwart, since he was rabidly anti-Semitic even by early 20th century German standards. And I know what you're thinking. How could he be anti-Semitic by those standards? Well, when Allwart formed his new political party, he didn't bother calling it anything so subtle or misleading as National Socialism. He came right out with it. The Anti-Semitic People's Party. The German esoteric psychiatrist Mathilde Ludendorff took Dahmer and Allwart's already outlandishly racist and implausible theories, combined them, and added a dash of her own flavor to the soup. She said that the Masons had joined forces with the Jews, as well as the Jesuits, to kill Mozart as part of a grand plan to create a new, global, Jewish-run world order. But the most notorious of the myriad Mozart murderers is, without a doubt, Antonio Salieri. A fellow composer and music teacher of the era.
Mozart!
Years after Mozart's death, Salieri went mad, attempted to slash his throat with a straight razor, failed, and ended up in a madhouse. Where, rumors had it, he would make raving confessions of having killed his former rival. There's little reason to believe those rumors are true, and even less reason to think that if Salieri did indeed say such things, he was being truthful. But 5 years after Salieri's death, the Russian playwright Alexander Pushkin used those rumors as the basis of a play entitled Mozart and Salieri. In 1898, the Russian composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov adapted that play into an opera. And in 1979, the English playwright Peter Schaeffer took those works as the basis for his play, Amadeus, which was adapted 5 years later into a Milos Forman film of the same name. While the Salieri in Schaeffer's version only believes himself to be Mozart's murderer in a spiritual sense, because he wished for his death, plenty, plenty of other more literally inclined people have run away with the idea. The point that Carhausen was making in Mozart's 140 Causes of Death and 27 Mental Disorders was that, facing a vacuum of evidence, we all favor our prejudices. Rheumatologists see autoimmune disorders. Cardiologists see endocarditis. Pharmacologists see poisoning. And anti-Semites see, well, what else? But, you ask with growing impatience, what the hell does any of this have to do with Christmas? And the answer is actually the paper itself. Why would the British Medical Journal, one of the most prestigious journals in the world, publish a cheeky meta-analysis of every proposed cause of death of an 18th century Viennese composer? Because it was Christmas. And every Christmas since 1985, the British Medical Journal has set aside its December issue as a time to publish weird stuff. Not fake stuff, not pranks or jokes or hoaxes, exactly. In fact, by their own stated guidelines, quote, "Research papers in the Christmas issue adhere to the same high standards of novelty, methodological rigor, reporting transparency, and readability as the regular issue. Christmas papers are subject to the same competitive selection and peer review process as all research papers." But while that's true, arguably true, the stuff that makes it into the BMJ Christmas issue is usually bizarre, or outlandish, or frivolous, or stupid, or, yeah, weird. Just plain weird. Lots weirder than Mozart. So today, we're going to find ourselves some of the yummiest Christmas cookies in the British Medical Journal jar. This is The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, A Very BMJ Christmas.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
2. It saves on tires.
Sam Schuster was a professor of dermatology at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital for many years. When he retired, he went looking for a hobby, which he eventually found while perusing a catalog for a gift for his grandson, a glimmering chrome unicycle. After staring at it for what must have been too long a time, his wife implored him to, quote, just buy the bloody thing, and so he did. Soon after, Sam Schuster got the idea for a research paper, the perfect fit for the BMJ Christmas edition, entitled Sex, Aggression, and Humor: Responses to Unicycling. What he noticed was what you would expect him to notice, that he got a lot of attention when unicycling around town. But Shuster decided to catalog and evaluate the reactions he received, to look for patterns and, as he put it, an underlying biological phenomenon that explained them. He collected more than 400 responses and came away with what, again, are not very surprising conclusions. Less than 5% of all people showed no reaction to his unicycle, even though he wore a bland tracksuit and trainers, rode, quote, neutrally with no attempt to entertain, and tried to keep his facial expression blasé. More than 90% made a physical response, anything from a wave or a smile to mock fear to a few motorists who swerved as if trying to run him off the road. Not cool. Around half the people responded verbally. Broken down by gender, 95% of the verbal responses from women were broadly positive, praise, encouragement, or concern. Male responses were, not so positive, le choc. Where things start to get the teensiest bit unusual is in the age distributions. Children, of all stripes, were mostly curious, asking questions like, was it hard to learn? Or the even more primordial, why? But around the teenage years, the questions from boys grew more foreboding. Questions directed at one another, like, do you want to knock him over? With the accompanying answer, I bet I could. Adolescent responses also included imperatives, the most notable being, fall off, granddad! While others offered the same sentiment as a prediction, you're gonna fall off. Still others threw stones at him. As males grew into adulthood, their responses tempered to insults and jokes. As Shuster writes, equally striking was their repetitive nature. Even though given as if original, almost 66% of these comic responses referred to the number of wheels, the absence of handlebars, or a part having been lost or stolen. Some remarks were fired off as if they had been rehearsed on approach. More often, people paused briefly while trying to formulate the response, which was sometimes delivered after I had passed. Shuster tracked this trend, from curiosity to rising aggression to aggression masked by increasingly banal commentary and jokes to average testosterone levels in males by age, and came to a conclusion. The consistent content of the male joke, he wrote, and its triumphant delivery, as if it was original and funny, even when it was neither, was remarkable, and it suggests a common underlying mechanism. The evolution of the response provides the clue to what this might be. The idea that unicycling is intrinsically funny cannot explain the findings. I do think that idea can go a little of the way there, Sam. And the notion that males are just expressing a greater sense of humor simply restates an observational fact. The simplest and most direct explanation is androgen-induced virility. Such a causal association fits well with the observed evolution to aggression, an attribute related to androgens. But direct endocrine confirmation would require studies not available to a unicyclist. Particularly interesting for the evolution of humor was the way the initial aggressive intent channeled the verbal response into a contrived but more subtle and sophisticated joke, in which aggression is concealed by wit. This shows how the aggression that leads to humor eventually becomes separated from it as wit, jokes, and other comic forms, which then take on an independent life of their own. These observations lead to the conclusion that humor evolves from androgen-primed aggression. Half interesting, though also pretty predictable, right? But the important bit is that Shuster included a table of the jokes. So let's let them rip! Lost your wheel? Hey, do you know you've only got one wheel? I'll look for your other wheel. Couldn't afford the other wheel? You've lost your handlebars. Where's the other bits then? Thought about joining the circus? Didn't know the circus was in town. I suppose it saves on tires. You park your bike for 2 minutes and that's what you're left with? It's quicker to walk. Does it crush your bollocks, mate? I know, they're not great. Sam Schuster is right. The best joke in the table, to my mind, is this unpolished gem. And what were your other birthday presents? Which isn't great, but it's something. For sure, the funniest part of the paper comes in the footnotes, and comes from Sam himself. Under the competing interests section, he notes none, apart from owning a bicycle as well as a unicycle. Just another hit job from a shill for big bike.
Three, all in the execution.
The first BMJ Christmas edition was organized in 1982, and right out of the gate, it produced some strong entries. There was an analysis of the experiences of surgeons on board 19th century whaling ships. Ooh, my cup of tea. A hypothesis of repetitive occupational elbow injury from jailers slamming doors. A proposal that doctors and researchers pre-write their own obituaries, and a lab analysis of the effects of drinking 6 beers in 3 hours, conducted by 6 doctors upon themselves. The result? A lot of peeing. My favorite of the initial spree of Christmas papers goes back to a case file taken in the year 1650. And I'll warn you now that this story starts off very dark, especially if you're sensitive to miscarriage, rape, murder, and the general cruelty of the Western world towards women. I'll also warn you, in a sunnier way, that it has a happy ending. This is the story of Anne Green. Anne Green was a 22-year-old scullery maid in the Oxford home of Justice Thomas Reed when, in 1650, she was, in her words, seduced by his honor's 17-year-old grandson, Geoffrey. She later began to grow sick, but she and the rest of the staff chalked this up to her work turning fermented barley to malt. 17 weeks after her encounter with Geoffrey, Anne discovered that her nausea was not due to her chores, when she spontaneously miscarried in the privy. Surprised, and no doubt frightened, Anne attempted to hide the remains of the fetus. This would soon prove to be a very serious mistake. Not that she had a lot of good options. From the moment Geoffrey began pursuing her, if not before, the path of Anne Green's life only had treacherous forks. But, probably unbeknownst to her, concealing the miscarriage was the most perilous branch of all. Soon after, the body was discovered and Anne was arrested for infanticide. At trial, she testified that she had not known she was pregnant, and that was backed up by the testimonies of her fellow house staff. A midwife was brought in to testify that the fetus was too young to have ever survived. It was not a murder, but a miscarriage. But the distinction didn't matter. In 1624, the English Parliament had passed the Concealment of Birth of Bastards Act. This law said that if a woman hid a pregnancy, as Anne had, she forewent the opportunity to plead stillbirth. The act of concealment made the case a murder, whether there was a murder to conceal or not. So, the court sentenced her, with some regret and hesitation, to be hung from the neck. Her execution was set for December 14th, 1650, in a horse pasture outside Oxford Castle. At the event, Anne was given a certain amount of sympathy. The officials read prayers for her and publicly chastised the Reed family for their mistreatment of her, which had led her to the noose. Because of that sympathy, Anne was granted a certain mercy. There was no gallows in the pasture. Instead, the convicted was meant to climb a ladder and then step off of it. The drop was not enough to snap the neck. Instead, the victim would die by slow strangulation over the course of hours. The kindness gifted to Anne was that the court allowed her friends and family to expedite her death by pulling on her legs with all their weight over and over and striking her in the head with the butt of a musket. Through this intervention, Anne was rendered limp and lifeless in a comparatively brief 30 minutes, at which point she was subject to the next phase of English law. In 1549, King Edward VI, looking to improve the training of physicians, had issued an order that medical students at Oxford must both view and perform 2 autopsies prior to graduation. It was a sound reform, except that it required the university to be kept flush with fresh cadavers, which it strained to do. Until 1636, when, to solve the issue, Charles I, in his charter to the school, decreed that Oxford had the right to demand the bodies of any persons executed within 21 miles of Oxford. So, once the deed was done, Anne Green was put in a coffin and carried to a nearby house where an anatomy student at Oxford named William Petty was living. Along with his instructor, Thomas Willis, Petty took possession of the coffin and set up to anatomize the just executed Anne Green. But before he could make the first incision, Petty witnessed the body making a breath. Anne Green was not dead. Petty and Willis then began trying to resuscitate her, and this they did through pretty questionable means. A lot of their efforts were concentrated on Anne's extremities. They rubbed her hands and feet, tied up her arms and legs with compression bandages. They force-fed her hot cordial, tickled her throat with a feather, and literally blew smoke up her ass. They opened a vein and bled her for 5 ounces. Less counterproductively, they covered her in heating pads and put her in bed with a woman to be spooned back to life. More in spite of than because of their interventions, Anne Green lived. Within 24 hours, she was able to speak and answer questions, although her mind and memory were understandably cloudy. In 4 days, she was able to eat solid food. In a month, she had fully recovered, other than a veil of amnesia that settled over the events of her execution. Anne Green's story was told in many ways very rapidly. She was the subject of a legion of poems in multiple languages and with very varying styles and tones. Some were highfalutin, like the one written by a young Christopher Wren.
Wonder of highest art! He that will reach a strain for thee had need his muse should stretch, till flying to the shades she learn what vein of Orpheus called Eurydice again, or learn of her Apollo, till she can as well as singer prove physician.
Yada, yada, yada. Others were punchy, like this limerick.
Anne Green was a slippery queen, in vain did the jury detect her. She cheated Jack Ketch, and then the vile wretch escaped the knife of the learned dissector.
While others were predictably misogynistic.
Admire not. 'Tis no news. Ne'er think it strange. 'Twere wonder if a woman should not change. They have mysterious ways, and their designs must be read backwards still, like Hebrew lines. See, these with death dissemble, and can cheat Charon himself to make a fair retreat. Well, for this trick, lie never so be led, as to believe a woman, though she's dead.
Classy. These poems were collected in one of the 2 pamphlets that made their way into popular circulation, spreading the story far and wide. And those pamphlets make for an interesting contrast. One, by William Burdett, was entitled A Wonder of Wonders, and the other, by Richard Watkins, was called News from the Dead. Watkins' take is what landed Anne Green in the first Christmas edition of the BMJ. He was clinical, detailed, and down-to-earth, giving an almost moment-by-moment account of the resuscitation and recovery, including a fine look into the state and recovery of her memory. It was such a competent piece of science that in 1982, J. Trevor Hughes submitted it, arguing that it met all the standards for inclusion in a modern academic journal, although it was written 5 years before the first academic journal was even created, making it, so far as I know, the oldest academic medical paper in existence. But A Wonder of Wonders has its own mark of distinction. Burdett was entirely uninterested in a thorough, level accounting of the facts. His take on Anne Green was that she was miraculously saved by God because of her innocence, not to mention a special prayer she said, which readers could learn for themselves upon purchase. And while Watkins described the return of her memory of her old life, Burdett described memories of her afterlife. According to him, she returned with visions of a garden of paradise, replete with cherubim, who imparted to her messages of warning to the unrighteous. Watkins answered this directly in News from the Dead, writing, "It may perhaps be expected by some, and 'tis pity I can give them no satisfaction, that I should relate some story of what fine visions this maid saw in the other world. But for such matters, the ballad makers must rest contented, since she, as you have heard, was so far from knowing anything whilst she was dead that she remembered not what had happened to her even when she was yet alive." Burdett and Watkins also disagreed on what happened to Anne after her recovery. According to Burdett, some angry and powerful men tried to have her rehung, but she was cut loose by a brigade of righteously indignant soldiers. Watkins says instead that her salvation was taken by the court as proof of her innocence, especially after Justice Thomas Reed, having heard of her recovery, dropped dead 3 days later. Both of them agreed that she won a royal pardon after the stay. And after that, Anne Green's bad luck was over. In Robert Plott's The Natural History of Oxfordshire, written in 1677, he relates a story that pretty neatly tracks with Watkins, but his goes further and details the rest of Anne's life. During her recovery, and afterwards, her father charged a fee to anyone who wanted to come see her for themselves, and a lot of people did. He earned her enough money to pay for that pardon, her medical treatment, her room and board. She had enough money to move out to the country, where she married and had 3 children, and, until her death, continued to be among the most famous women of the age. Anyone who saw her would recognize her, since she carried her own coffin around until the end.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Four. The other MIT.
Over the 40 years that the British Medical Journal has been running its Christmas edition, there have been more than 1,000 articles published, running all sorts of gamuts. Studies on how fast different varieties of chocolate disappear from hospitals, how the size of the average wine glass has changed over the course of the last century, an analysis of the health effects of sword swallowing, a catalog of food and drink named after doctors, tests of urban myths like whether you can get drunk via vodka foot bath, whether old joints predict the weather, and whether beauty sleep really makes you more beautiful. No, no, yes, for the record. There have been examinations of the behaviors, careers, and health of numerous fictional characters, from the Hulk to Dr. Watson to James Bond. Not all BMJ Christmas articles are so frivolous, though. One early issue detailed the then largely untold story of the first lab to successfully culture and administer penicillin. Another detailed how a French team confirmed the identity of King Henry IV's head. Narrowing down a list of the best Christmas articles is kind of impossible, given all that. But the most popular BMJ Christmas article is undisputed. It comes from the 2014 issue, and the abstract begins as follows. Sex differences in risk-seeking behavior, emergency hospital admissions, and mortality are well documented. However, little is known about sex differences in idiotic risk-taking behavior. The paper, entitled The Darwin Awards, Sex Differences in Idiotic Behavior, sought to fill that gap. In case you're unfamiliar with the Darwin Awards, the paper provides an impressively succinct explanation. Winners of the Darwin Award must eliminate themselves from the gene pool in such an idiotic manner that their actions ensure one less idiot will survive. See, there are plenty of evolutionary theories for why risk-taking behavior is higher among men, and indeed, among most male primates. But, say the authors, all of these theories fall apart in the face of sex discrepancy among Darwin Award winners, because there is no potential payoff to these risks, and they end quite finally with death. So, the authors provide a new theory, MIT, or Male Idiot Theory. Quoting again, according to male idiot theory, many of the differences in risk-seeking behavior, emergency department admissions, and mortality may be explained by the observation that men are idiots, and idiots do stupid things. As evidence for MIT, the authors pull out examples from the Darwin Awards, like a thief who attempted to steal a cable from an elevator while aboard the elevator. A man who, looking for a lift home, attached a shopping cart to the back of a train, and a terrorist who mailed a bomb and then opened the package when it was returned to him for insufficient postage. They looked at the sum total of Darwin Award recipients and eliminated the 14 cases in which men and women died together, cases we might call fucking idiots. They also nixed honorary mentions, where the individual did not fully eliminate their reproductive potential, such as the man who managed to save one of his testicles with a staple gun after he slipped on a belt sander with which he was masturbating. Here is a moment to let that sentence sink in. After all exclusions, they were left with 318 case studies, a whopping 282 of which involved men, 88.7%. There are a number of other possible explanations for the disparity: selection bias, reporting bias, and differences in alcohol consumption, chief among them. Social factors may, read, do, incentivize certain stupid behavior in men, and evolutionary pressures for social dominance and mating selection could all be involved. But, conclude the authors, MIT provides a parsimonious explanation of differences in idiotic behavior. But not so fast, because, as I said, this has been the most read, quoted, and otherwise popular article in BMJ Christmas history, and a disconcerting proportion of the commentary and citation around it doesn't seem to get the joke. And that misunderstanding does not appear to be gendered, which would slightly undercut the otherwise distressingly strong male idiot theory.
5. If at first you don't succeed.
I think that my favorite Christmas article, and it really is a horse race, is another of the all-time BMJ hits. Magnetic resonance imaging of male and female genitals during coitus and female sexual arousal, which does exactly what it says on the tin. Takes MRI scans of couples doing it. What the researchers learned from this was not what makes the study great, so let's just get it out there at the top. First of all, they made the not very shocking observation that the penis during missionary position takes a banana shape. In what seems like even less of a headline, they dispelled the idea that the uterus expands during coitus, which seems like a no-brainer, but an earlier anatomical study of sex from the 60s had shown that, so good to get some clarity there. The third big conclusion the researchers drew starts to get at the fun of this study, and that is the fundamental fact that they showed it was possible to collect MRI data from people mid-porking. That conclusion took the better part of 7 years to confirm. Between 1992 and 1999, the researchers hit a lot of speed bumps. There were the ethics concerns, the unwanted publicity, the seeking of clearance from the hospital to use a very expensive piece of diagnostic equipment to do the nasty. There was also the sticky issue of finding participants, which was done by going on local television and asking people to submit. But the main issue was performance, because it turns out that the inside of a working MRI machine is not conducive to romance. The researchers seem to have been taken by surprise with this revelation, which is itself astonishing, seeing as I, personally, can name the floors of 14 fast food establishments in which I would rather bump uglies before choosing a fully enclosed and narrow tube that makes this sound the whole time. Making sure the couples were slight enough just to handle the basic logistics of the task was tough, but the environment and clinical atmosphere of the proceedings proved a bridge too far for most of the participants. In each of 13 experiments, the woman was asked to lie on her back in the MRI for an initial scan. So far, so good. Then the man was to climb into the tube, and then climb into the tube, if you catch me. Once he was in, and in, the couple were told to hold their position while the MRI calibrated, acquired the image, and took the pictures, a process which took longer than a minute. All the while, the researchers looked on, and in, and the machine made its deafening noise. We did not foresee that the men would have more problems with sexual performance, maintaining their erection, than the women in the scanner, the highly educated and accomplished authors of the paper wrote, all of them with terminal degrees. The researchers were able to get solo images of women during auto-orgasm, although the orgasms achieved through manual stimulation were described as superficial. But aside from the first couple, none of the participants were able to achieve full insertion until 1998. What changed that year was the introduction of a new research aid onto the market, Viagra. What about the first couple, though? To quote the study, on two Saturdays in 1991, experiments 1 and 2, the first couple succeeded with complete penetration that lasted sufficiently long for the images to be taken. So the whole thing might have been over and done right there, except that the imager was a very early MRI and produced an unsuitably low quality image, necessitating the next 6 years of launch failures. In that time, you may ask, why didn't the researchers go back to that first couple, the ones who were able to get the job done, rather than going on television and asking for new volunteers? Well, that would have been a problem of medical ethics, because the first couple were the researchers. They don't describe the process in exactly the sort of narrative detail I'd like, but it seems that one Saturday in 1991, two professors were hanging out around the MRI when they had the totally scientific and impartial idea to fuck in a magnet. And those two selfless self-experimenters were the only people able to get the job done without pharmaceutical intervention. These are the noble and high-minded things and people we do for science.
Six, a Christmas miracle.
You may by now have noticed a suspicious lack of Christmas in the BMJ Christmas edition. Eyeballing it, I would put the number of papers with a direct connection to the holiday at less than 5%, but that still leaves plenty of real seasonal science for us to end on. Going back to the MRI, hopefully after someone took a fresh towel to it, there's this 2015 paper out of the University of Copenhagen. They took images of the brains of 20 people being shown a series of pictures, some of which were Christmas-themed. The participants, too, were divided into Christmas-positive and Christmas-neutral groups, based on their answers to a survey about how they felt about the holiday, whether they celebrated, etc. Their results showed that the Christmasers displayed significantly greater activity in three regions of their brains: the sensory motor cortex, premotor and primary motor cortex, and the parietal lobe, than the group they termed as suffering from Bah Humbug Syndrome. The paper was entitled "Evidence of a Christmas Spirit Network in the Brain." In addition to locating the Christmas spirit, these authors had a secondary aim, which might sound familiar to you if you think back to our Psych Out series from earlier this year, to show that fMRI imaging studies like this one are bad science, but show it in a cheery, festive way. Extensive quote. "We realize that some of our colleagues within the specialties of neuroscience and psychology, who we suspect could be afflicted by the aforementioned Bah Humbug Syndrome, would argue that studies such as the present one overemphasize the importance of localized brain activity, and that attempts to localize complex emotions in the brain contribute little to the understanding of these emotions. Naturally, in keeping with the good spirit of the holiday, we disagree with these negative perspectives. We generally believe that fMRI is an outstanding technology for exploring the brain, but that any fMRI experiment is only as good as its hypothesis, design, and interpretation. Given these uncertainties and the risk of false positive results, our findings should ideally be reproduced before firm conclusions are drawn, especially when we consider the recently documented challenges of reproducibility in our neighboring specialty of psychology. Bringing these issues up, however, really dampened the festive mood. Therefore, we, in the best interest of the readers, of course, decided not to ruin the good Christmas cheer for everyone by letting this influence our interpretation of the study." Another very Christmas-forward Christmas paper was the observational study called "Why Rudolph's Nose is Red," which noted in its conclusion, "The nasal microcirculation of reindeer is richly vascularized, with a vascular density 25% higher than that in humans. These results highlight the intrinsic physiological properties of Rudolph's legendary luminous red nose, which helped to protect it from freezing during sleigh rides, and to regulate the temperature of the reindeer's brain, factors essential for flying reindeer pulling Santa Claus's sleigh under extreme temperatures." adorable, but not my favorite of the genre. That honor belongs to a 2013 longitudinal analysis out of UNC Chapel Hill, which looked at data from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, a large-scale, long-term data collection study of, well, yeah, Americans' health from early adolescence through their late 20s. Some of the data collected had to do with, what else, sexual history, including self-reporting of knowledge of contraception, religious beliefs on chastity, and the character of sex education classes completed. Most importantly, it included self-reporting of whether participants had ever become pregnant, as well as self-reporting on whether they'd ever had sex. UNC Chapel Hill looked at 7,870 female participants and saw that 5,340 of them had reported a pregnancy. But of those 5,340, 45 of them also said they were virgins. 45 virgin births out of 5,340 pregnancies. If those results were indicative of the larger population, that would mean that about 0.5% of all babies are immaculately conceived. How do you explain that? Well, for starters, the virgin pregnancies were clustered pretty significantly around a lack of sex ed, as well as around households that didn't discuss or explain sex, and which frowned on premarital relations. There was also some strong ambiguity around what the participants took as the definition of sexual intercourse, and what activities they believed were able to produce a pregnancy. That's probably sufficient, huh? But wait, there were also two other factors where the virgins stood out from the other pregnancies. They were more likely to give birth to boys, and they were more likely to learn they were pregnant during Advent. Ho, ho, ho! Merry British Medical Journal Christmas to all, and to all a good please support comprehensive sexual health education. See you next year. Music for today's episode provided by Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. An extra special Christmas thanks goes out to Mike Karstensen and Lori Hartenhoff, along with the rest of the patrons who make this show possible through their generous giving. You can be one of them, too, by going to patreon.com/theconstant and signing up. It'll get you early and ad-free access to new episodes, not to mention monthly bonus content. In a couple of days, that will include this year's special Christmas episode, a lovely story about space from none other than the wonderful Heather Chrysler. You should definitely jump on to hear it, but if you don't, I hope you will spread the word. Until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, whose contributions to the BMJ Christmas edition are surprisingly anemic, but include a baffling literary grudge match which dares to ask which book is better, Plutarch's Lives or Charlotte's Web. This has been The Constant. My money's on the talking spider. Leptospirosis. Dermatopolymyositis. Dermatopolymyositis. You got me there, medicine. I think this might be my most annoying episode yet.